Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. I'm delighted to say, yes, she's back. I'm joined today by perhaps the only cheese-loving feudal landlady currently working in literary journalism, although I've not tested that.
Surely not.
Thea Lena Dootsey. Thea, hello.
Hello.
Happy New Year to you.
Hello, Happy New Year.
Welcome back, and we've got a lovely show to do today.
We have indeed.
It's very exciting, actually, and I'll tell you why shortly, but if you want to subscribe to the TLS, that means you're not doing it already. Shame on you. Google TLS subscriptions and type POD1 in the offer code section. You can get 6 issues for £6. So subscribe to the TLS, review this podcast on iTunes, etc., etc. We have an inordinate amount of great stuff to discuss this week. Writer and broadcaster Marcel Theroux will be in the studio to discuss the tale of Nicholas Notovich, a Russian purveyor of hashtag fake news about Jesus from the Victorian period. Intrigued? You should be. We have a Middle Eastern special in the paper this week, and the Palestinian journalist Lina Al-Safin will be on the line to discuss her review of books that might be said to represent conflict tourism in the area. How much good does writing about Israeli occupation actually do? Our political editor Toby Lishtig will pop in to add his thoughts as well. And we all discuss writing about autism, that often mislabeled and misunderstood condition, with the author Francesca Happe, who has reviewed 2 memoirs by people with autism themselves. Let's begin by telling the story of a forger, an unreliable storyteller, a fraud. Nicholas Notovich, a Russian-born resident of Paris at the turn of the 20th century, wrote a book called The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ, containing this rather weighty claim. During the lost years of Jesus' life, the gap in the Bible between his childhood and the beginning of his ministry in Palestine, Jesus visited India and trained as a Buddhist monk. His evidence was a mysterious document with leaves yellowed by the lapse of time he had found in a remote monastery in the highlands of Ladakh in India. Written in the ancient language of Pali, it told of the travels in India of a man called Issa, who looked a lot like the Jesus of the Gospels. Is it credible? Probably not, as Marcel Theroux has found out, but the reasons for the fabrication are fascinating. Marcel used the stories as a basis for his beautiful new novel, The Secret Books, which a review in the TLS has thankfully called a deeply moving moral story. Otherwise, this would have been an awkward few moments, and has given us the factual account in an essay in this week's paper. In The Secret Books, Marcel referred to the idea of books containing other beliefs that might be richer, truer, fairer, and kinder than reality. Is that what Notovich was trying to achieve? Well, Marcel Theroux joins Thea and me in the studio now. Welcome.
Hi,
to you, Marcel.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it would have been awkward if we
I think I would have. I'd like to think I'm thick-skinned enough to have past it. No, impossible.
You'd have just said no, wouldn't you? Quite right, too. Let's start at the beginning with this chap. Am I pronouncing it right? Nicholas Notovich.
Well, probably not, but I call him Notovich.
Notovich.
But I think in Russian his name would have been Notovich.
Notovich.
Notovich. Okay.
Who was he, and what did he claim?
So he was a journalist and spy who was born in the Russian Empire in about 1858, who then showed up in Paris, worked for various quite legitimate news organisations. Then in 1894, he published this extraordinary book, The Unknown Life of Jesus, which he claimed he'd found. He claimed he'd found the text that forms the heart of it in Hemis Monastery in Ladakh. And he said, as you explained in your intro, that it proved that Jesus had spent his lost years studying Hinduism and Buddhism in India. And Notovitch himself is kind of shadowy. I mean, we know this much about him. There's a bibliography. There are other books that he wrote. He turns up in a French Dictionary of National Biography. There's no biography of him, though, and no one knows when he died. That's a matter of conjecture. And actually, in my investigations into Notovitch, I learned that he lived much longer than anyone knew.
Because he pops up in
1939. Paris.
Yeah. In 1939, yeah. That's right. In the London Library, I thought I might as well read all the books that I could get my hands on by Notovitch. And I found a book called Russia and the English Alliance in the London Library. And the flyleaf is inscribed by Notovitch in blue ink to the Duchess of Kent. And I felt this kind of thrill as
Did
I
you,
saw it.
That must be so exciting.
Well, it was so exciting. I wasn't sure whether it was exciting or whether I'd gone so deep into my nerdish enthusiasm that, you know, only I would find it exciting. But the idea that I'd actually caught up to a place where he'd actually been and that he'd lived to 1939 is almost touching distance.
Yeah.
Well, what led you to him in the first place?
So what led me to him was I was really interested in apocryphal stories about Jesus. And I had been reading the Gnostic Gospels by Elaine Pagels, which is a book about, you know, these other texts that didn't make it into the Bible, a text that turned up in the 20th century that tell these kind of alternate stories about Christianity. And I'd always been struck by the similarities between, say, Taoism or Buddhism and elements of Christianity that I find really attractive. You know, that the Tao is about yin and yang, but about light being cleaved from dark, which is also how Genesis begins, right? So that seems like an uncanny parallel. But also in Sermon of the Mount and in the Gospel of Thomas, which is another Gnostic text, the Jesus that you read about is kind of strangely Buddha-like in the things he said. And he doesn't perform miracles. He says wise things. And so it struck me, maybe there is a link between Buddhism and Christianity, and it's by no means impossible that some news travelled along the Silk Road and reached Palestine. And then I turned up this old story. It turned out that in 1894, this Russian guy, Nicholas Notovitch, who I found on the internet, this is about 2002, when his Wikipedia entry was only two lines, both of which were wrong. It said he was the son of a nobleman and a Cossack adventurer.
Did he write to it himself, do you think? Somehow.
Probably not impossible, yeah. I suppose.
He's and, still alive. Yeah.
That would be a great twist.
Yeah, it would, yeah. Please, if you're listening.
You can have it.
If Nicholas Notovitch is listening to the podcast, please phone in.
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. There's this guy published this book in 1894, which he claimed he'd found in Tibet in 1807. Why don't more people know about this? My second thought was, is it true? I mean, is it possible that he really went to a monastery in Ladakh and found such a manuscript?
So you went to the monastery?
I did. I went to the monastery about a year. I'd written a draft of my novel, The Secret Books. But because I'd always thought we've got to give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe it is true. I mean, by that stage, I have to admit, I was pretty sure he wasn't telling the truth and he'd written the book for other reasons. But I thought I'd go there. I wanted to go there anyway. And also to see what the place looks like and to have a sense of walking in his footsteps and see if there was something in the atmosphere that would help me with the book.
Very little oxygen, it turns out.
Very little oxygen. You feel absolutely appalling as you get out of the plane. It is like a foretaste of being 80 years old. You have real difficulty filling your lungs. But conversely, when you come down from that altitude, you feel absolutely fantastic.
Do you?
You have so many red blood cells in your body. Yeah. You feel brilliant for about a day. Then
that's a top tip. Yeah
top tip. Yeah. Yeah, really cheer you up. Come down from a high altitude.
So you get to the monastery and...
I went to see the deputy abbot was there, and I talked to him about it. I felt like he was too polite to say, look, mate, you just wasted your time. Like, there's no way this is true. I felt that would have been a kind of un-Buddhist thing to say to a traveller who'd come all that way. But he more or less said, look, there's no books in Pali in here, and I've really heard this story, but I really don't know, in a way that suggested, you know, you're out of luck, but if more people want to come and ask, we'd be very happy to accept their donations to the monastery. And in fact, that was more or less what people said soon after the book was published. He was the flavour of the month He was the flavour of the month for about 6 months.
The New York Times wrote an article sort of semi-straight, didn't they?
Several. There were several New York Times. The book was published in French and it was quickly translated into a lot of other languages. And it's still around. You can go on Amazon and buy it still. There are still people who subscribe, who think it may be true. It may even represent a kind of truth in that there may be elements of Buddhism in early Christianity. And who knows what Jesus was doing in his missing years. That's why it's not a story that could be scotched finally.
But so let's get to your theory, because you say that a lot of people didn't like him.
Right, you know. Notovitch. When he crops up in contemporaneous sources, people basically think he's a jumped up so-and-so.
A forger, a blunder, an unscrupulous chancer is how you put
right.
it. But you think he's doing something altruistic, which is connected to another book he wrote called The Truth About Jews.
Yeah, that's right. So the book he wrote, The Truth About Jews, which is this very dubious, a very scary-sounding title, isn't it? He published in Russia in about 1888, I think. And that's only available in Russian. So I had to pour through it with the help of a friend and with my kind of, you know, O-level Russian. But the truth about the Jews is actually not as bad as it sounds. It's really a story. It's really a book that's urging Jews to moderate their religion in a way that will make them acceptable to the Russian Empire and be integrated into the Russian Empire. Now, I'm not saying I think that would have been a good course of action for the Jews at that time to choose. But Jews in 19th century Russia were having a terrible time. They were discriminated against. They could only live in certain parts of the country. They couldn't get into institutions of higher learning. There was terrible job discrimination. You know, the life chances were terrible. So my supposition, and I think the evidence shows, is that Notovitch himself was a Jew. He was writing this as someone who'd converted from Judaism and reinvented him as an Orthodox Christian, was now living in Paris as a Christian. And I think he felt a kind of duty to his fellow Jews to try and improve their lives. And The Truth About the Jews was his first his first aim to do that. And I think The Unknown Life was his second.
And why is that? What's the thing he's doing there?
To understand that, you need to know a little bit about the roots of anti-Semitism. And I think, to me, this is a fascinating subject because it's really about storytelling. And
this is the bit that I think when your piece, because the first half's really interesting about him, but then I actually find this even more interesting.
Yeah, I was a kind of amazed when I read about this, which I did in the course of researching the book, is that so much of in the Bible and variously in the different Gospels, the Jews are presented as the Jewish community in Jerusalem are presented as the people who called for Jesus' death, right, before Pilate. And it's their degree of culpability varies from gospel to gospel, but it's strongest in Matthew, where they say his blood be on us and upon our children. They insist that Pilate put Jesus to death, and Pilate does it very reluctantly, and there's that symbolic gesture where he washes his hands and says, you know, I absolve myself from this. And that story that obviously was written long after Jesus had died, becomes the basis for the accusation that the Jews are, as a people, collectively responsible for Jesus' death, that they have some kind of collective guilt. And there's, in the history of anti-Semitism, this is a key thing. And there's a book called The Anguish of the Jews, which is a survey history of 2,000 years of anti-Semitism written by a Catholic scholar. And he concludes that this deicide accusation is the fundamental thing behind anti-Semitism. It's the rock upon which anti-Semitism is built. And when you understand that and you read Notovitch's Gospel, which he quote unquote found in a Buddhist monastery, which, although its headline thing is that Jesus studied Buddhism, in its retelling of the gospel story, it switches the roles. The Jewish elders become the ones who plead for mercy, and they even take on the gesture that's attributed to Pilate in the Synoptic Gospel. They wash their hands of Jesus' murder, and Pilate is the one who puts Jesus' to death. He's the one who's solely responsible for it. So I think it was a kind of quixotic, noble, ultimately failed attempt to rewrite the gospel story and to relieve the Jewish people of this calumny which dogged them for 2,000 years.
And if anyone was in any doubt as to whether that needed, that rebalancing or redressing needed to happen. I mean, you cite a very recent high school basketball game
right.
in the US, just to show how kind of mainstream that culture is.
That's right, that the Jews killed, you killed Jesus, was at a high school basketball game in Boston.
That's just
petrifying. It's astonishing. I think, you know, unless you, I know, it's astonishing to me that something in a story 2,000 years ago can still be mobilised to traduce and humiliate an entire people.
And there's an ironic parallel with this book, The Unknown Life of Jesus, with another fake news, Russian fake news book
right.
written at the same time, which I think people will be familiar with. I think that there's a kind of very famously cancerous book, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a fake Jewish conspiracy about how Jewish people want to take over the world,
yeah,
which was written
right.
in Russia not at a dissimilar time.
Well, it was probably written in Paris at that time, but it was published in Russia in 1905 for the first time. That's when it first sees the light of day. And it's funny because I feel like with my novel, I wanted people, if they took nothing else from it, for them to be aware of The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, because I'm never sure. It feels like the world's divided into people who know exactly what it is and the malign influence it exerted,
yeah.
and people who've never heard of it. And I imagine if you're Jewish, you know exactly what it is. But lots of people have never heard of The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And in a sense, it is the grandmother of all fake news stories. And you can see it's still present in stories about, in conspiracy theories, things about the Bilderberg Group or the idea that the world is being run by a shadowy cabal.
Yeah.
That's right.
I used to do an LBC radio show, and I've done things on conspiracies, or even when I'm not doing things on conspiracies, and people call you up and say, yeah, but you're told to say that by the sort of Jewish conspiracies.
Right.
Jewish, you think, when's the meeting? Like, I've never been into a meeting where someone said, but guys, by the way, can we just cover this in this?
It's a very tenacious fantasy that the world works in that way, and that there is a shadowy room, a smoke-filled room somewhere where people are taking the decisions that affect
and that's
all
what
of us.
And that's what this protocol says.
Yeah, the protocol is absolutely that. But in the shadowy room they're all Jewish men, Jewish elders, who are deciding the fate of the world and deciding that they're going to control the media and lead Gentiles by the nose and take over the world and destroy the Christian religion. And I should say very quickly that the book's an utter forgery. And not only is it a forgery, it's a plagiarism too. It's a plagiarism of a French text by a writer called Maurice Joly. It's got it's got no basis in fact whatsoever. And yet it never. It's a zombie argument that never dies. However many stakes are driven through the heart of the protocols, it still lurches to its feet and carries on doing its malign work.
Novodvitch is a kind of a benign cousin of it.
Well, I think, this is conjecture, but Novodvitch is in Paris at around the time that it's being concocted. And I think it's not impossible that he knew its author, a guy called Pyotr Rachkovsky, who was the head of the Russian secret police in Paris, whose job it was to snuffle around finding revolutionaries who were trying to overthrow the Tsarist government, who was trying to stop. He was essentially leading a war on terror, you know, of its time. And it's under Rachkovsky's guidance that the protocols was concocted, essentially to make the progressive movement in Russia look as though it was being led by a Jewish conspiracy, because nothing would make it more impotent than the accusation that it was actually a tool in the hands of Russia's most loathed minority. So Rachkovsky has it forged to achieve a kind of here and now function, which is to make progressives look like they're tools in the hands of the Jews, and yet it goes on to have this power. And I think Notovitch was possibly aware that this was going on. Even in my sort of darkest and most fearful fantasies, I wonder if Notovitch had a hand in it.
Oh,
really?
Well, that's the novelist in me. Look at your faces fell.
Well, you
when
were drumming
I said,
your fingers on your chin as you said it.
Well, I think it's a kind of that would be the dark novelistic payoff, because he was a Russian speaking, French speaking person who was making his living with a pen in Paris, who was moving in circles that were connected in the secret police, with experience in forgery. It's not a million miles away.
But it's against his whole agenda that you've just spelled out.
Imagine the remorse he'd have felt.
Well, here's the other thing. We don't know what happens to Notovitch, but if he's in Paris in 1939, it is not impossible, as a person of Jewish origin, he was 2 years away, if he'd lived, to have been carted off to the camps. I mean, his story could have ended
absolutely
with the great One of the great pogroms against Jewish people.
The
Holocaust.
That's absolutely right. So in my novel, I chose Notovitch to be telling a story in 1933 because I thought, you know, because it has that terrible kind of dramatic irony of what's to come. That by the time 1933, Notovitch is old and his story is an old kind of derided thing that's been kind of cast off and rejected by history. But in fact, the worst is yet to come, and the most virulent form of anti-Semitism is about to come into power.
And that was the last trace that you could find then in 1939. Then the trail goes cold.
That's right, absolutely. Yeah. And no one knew that he lived that long. And that's all I have. I really tried to figure out where he was, but he really went quiet after about 1905, and. Yeah, so it's just that weird accident of finding the book in the London Library, which this feels like a thing I made up, but you can imagine the frisson.
The dedication to the Duchess of Kent as well, I find that puzzling. Why would that be?
She was in Paris. She was in Paris at that time, and I believe I remember doing some research on that. She was based in Paris. I can't remember why. You can imagine he's an elderly old fellow, quite a character at some sort of soiree, meeting foreign royalty. And, you know, the sense you get about him, having read as much as I can about him, is that he was a social climber. Yeah. It doesn't surprise me at all that he wanted to try and pal up to some British royalty. And who knows, maybe he thought that would be London would have been probably a good next move for him.
Let's hope he made it. In 1940, yeah. He was in London bludging off the royal family.
Yeah, I'd like to think so.
Let's end the story. Marcel, it's a wonderful piece. It's a great book. I'm glad we liked it in the paper. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And so to the Middle East, that seemingly inexhaustible font of violence, injustice and frustration. We have a run of pieces this week carrying us across the region and a little beyond to take in power transmission in medieval Iran, the story of Abdullah Quilliam, a Victorian convert to Islam, as well as the underreported plight of African refugees in modern-day Israel and a journey to the heart of Yazidi culture. We'll begin, though, in Israel, where, while President Trump and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu treat peace negotiations like just another real estate deal, in the streets and in the camps, people are increasingly manipulated and polarised, with peace and daily life ever more precarious. All of this has been helped along, argues Lina Al-Safin in this week's paper, by an Israeli propaganda machine that has successfully dominated a story of Jewish security, wars fought in self-defence, a nation that made the desert bloom. It has even been argued, she points out, citing Anat Berko of the Likud party, whose chairman, we should say, is Netanyahu himself, that there is no such entity as the Palestinians because the letter P does not exist in the Arabic alphabet. If we do hear alternative views, stories or reports about Palestinian life under the boot of Israeli occupiers, they are generally written by foreign writers and caricature often predominates. So one question for today is how best to challenge these versions of the story and re-envisage the region's past, present and future. And then, what good does it do anyway? Lina joins us on the phone from Qatar now. Lina, hi.
Hello. Hi.
You've reviewed three books for this piece. Do these books manage to get beyond caricature?
Yes, of course. So the whole point of writing about Palestinians and their lives under occupation, one of them was to set them apart from the caricatures that have been portrayed of them in mainstream media. Another is also about raising awareness of the occupation, an audience that has been for too long accustomed to only one side of the narrative. There are, however, I've experienced this firsthand, some of these stories that have been reported about, they become shaped or molded into ways that fit kind of like the Western narrative more in a way to kind of create some sort of affinity between the readers and the Palestinians themselves. And that shouldn't be too much of a problem, except when it is actually. So one example recently is the arrest of a Palestinian teenager, Ahed Tamimi, who was caught on film slapping and insulting an Israeli soldier. And later that night, the Israeli army came and arrested her from her house. Now, her case took off and it spread like wildfire, in part due to how she looks. So Ahed Tamimi has long, curly, blonde hair and blue eyes. And the attention that has been given into her case has been largely centered on that. But there are other writers who have used, you know, through the beautiful depictions and their words, how they've set a light on the hardships and the difficulties that face Palestinian families and individual members on their day-to-day life under Israeli occupation.
And what do you think it's like for those people who are being endlessly visited? How do you, as a Palestinian and a writer, how do you feel about that constant kind of presence?
I think now there is more and more a sort of collective sense of frustration at these visits or at this attention from international writers, because Palestinians' words are no longer enough. It is time, or it's way overdue, for some concrete action to take place. So in the past, you know, we've cultivated this sense of, well, this is the entire conflict or the Israeli occupation. A big part of it owes a lot to the propaganda that the Israeli government uses. And for a long time, the Palestinians have sought to counter that. But I think nowadays, it's past the time where we can use words, especially in this information era where we live in. So if someone wants to find out something about anything, you know, information is literally available right at their fingertips. So there isn't that excuse of ignorance, you know, when it's so readily available. So we're kind of past the awareness stage now, and what people want to see is more like concrete action taken by the governments, by the international community who've forsaken the Palestinians. Whenever international writers, and they're always welcomed, by the way, I mean, I don't think anyone has ever like slammed the front door in the face of these people, but it gets to the point where how long must they, or how many times must they continue to relive their pain and their experience and, you know, their frustrations, just for someone to kind of sap into this world that is completely different from the world that they know.
Does it feel patronizing? I wonder whether, because there's a phrase, conflict tourism, which does appear in your piece. Can it feel patronizing that it's almost a great thing for a writer of sensibility to do? They can go and, you know, produce beautiful phrases that roll nicely round the mouth. They can look appropriately empathetic. And actually, there's kind of a patronizing possibility there.
There is definitely. And you've touched upon this thing. And there's another aspect to it as well, where for journalists, they use Palestine-Israel as the springboard that launches them into, you know, the world of journalism. Basically, it looks amazing on their CV if they, you know, put down their experience covering Israel-Palestine. And what they have in reality, what they do is basically, you know, kind of just talk to Palestinians and get this information, but sometimes it's not really done with as much finesse as you would hope that they would have. So it is a bit patronizing. And another example, not necessarily to do with writing, but it all kind of connects to this thing, is Banksy's art on the separation barrier or apartheid wall or whatever you want to call it. And recently, his off the wall tourist hotel, which he opened earlier this year, and it overlooks a part of the separation barrier in the West Bank. And you know, you've got other graffiti artists like Lushucks, who they've also sprayed their art or got their graffiti on the wall. And some Palestinian artists, they've kind of defaced that because, you know, in protest of, this is not your canvas. This, for us, is a symbol of oppression and not your canvas. And all your arguments at, you know, raising awareness and grabbing the world's attention and so on and so forth, it kind of fall flat because, as I mentioned before, like, awareness is something that you can easily attain these days, and you don't really have much of an excuse of feigning ignorance when information is so readily available.
We've got Toby Lichtig, the policy editor of the TLS here. Do you agree with that, Toby?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the questions that I've always wondered about these books, and I've read several of them myself, but there's such an industry around them. It's who they're for. You know, who's reading them? You know, Verso, the publisher, churns them out in great quantities, Fourth Estate, Bloomsbury. And you sort of feel like they're being read by people perhaps like me in Britain and South Africa and in the States, who already sort of know what they think about the situation there. And there is a self-serving element to them that I see. And also when you talk about that CV thing, I mean, I've been in that position as a visiting journalist to Israel and you're taken on a tour. It's all very easy and sanitised. You jump on a minibus, you go to Hebron, you get taken around. It's, you know, deeply depressing and awful to see the situation there. And then you get bused back to Jerusalem or whatever, and you write about it. And yeah, I really get your sense of frustration at that. I think it really shines through in the piece.
I actually spoke, Lena, to Michael Chabon about this mm-hmm. book once, and he said to me, "Oh, we're doing this book. I've edited this book, and it's pretty controversial. It's got a pretty controversial view of the situation." And I remember thinking, I don't know, it's controversial. It's sort of Zionist, because. But he said to me, "No. It's sympathetic towards the Palestinians." And I was like, "Well, where I'm from, and in I think Britain probably much more than America, that perspective isn't even that new to me. I think there's a great, and this way, when you talk about Israeli propaganda, I'm struck by that, because certainly in there's large swathes of the British population are very pro-Palestinian. They don't see it as particularly controversial to adopt a Palestinian position. They can recognise the illegality of the occupation. Is this an American thing where this is controversial? Because Chabon was worried about this book coming out, because in America, being empathetic to Palestinians was a massive controversy. That doesn't feel like a controversy over here.
Oh, well, of course. I mean, if you factor into the account that the U.S. Is Israel's biggest supporters and financial backers, and how, you know, they contribute $3 billion a year in military aid. So the culture of speaking out against Israel is not as prevalent as it is in the U.K. The solidarity movement, or the mainstreaming of solidarity with Palestinians, is not as easy as it is in the UK. But, you know, I think the US just needs more time and more decades of movement building, basically. But apart from that, it's also at the top level, the government level. Yeah. You know, it's not just about people advocating for change, but it also goes to the government level and their willingness to actively recognize that that Israel as a state in its current state cannot be allowed to function.
Well, this asks a bigger question, Lena. Do writers matter? Actually, in the real world of geopolitics, in the real world of how the Middle East actually is, America is not going to give up its support of Israel. Israel is not going to, it would seem, give up its stance on Palestinians. Writers can write lovely prose. Do they matter? Do we actually overvalue the role of writers, do you think?
It was interesting. I was just having this conversation with a colleague earlier today about journalism in general, and whether it's the biggest farcical industry or not. Because we journalists, they like to claim that, you know, their words matter, and that they'll set the world on fire through exposing, you know, an issue here. But they can write many books about it, but will it actually change the ones who actually like control or hold all the power? That'd be an interesting study for an academic paper.
American journalism mattered, Donald Trump wouldn't be in the White House. Seems to me a relatively straightforward equation that you could draw. That all the people who write sensible, thoughtful, long op-ed pieces in the New York Times, the Atlantic, all sorts of American outlets, mm-hmm. didn't stop Donald Trump being elected. And so you can make a case that people in journalism like to pride ourselves on its world-shattering impacts. But maybe we live in a world where you can actually brazen anything out. If the lessons of the last 3 years all over the world have been anything, it's that you can brazen mm-hmm. anything out if you just are brazen.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair point. And I think, like, when I wrote the article, it wasn't necessarily a critique of writers and their writings. It was more a reflection. But then that tied into the fact that historically traditionally, one associated journalism with, you know, having the impact to change something. But I feel like in today's world, that is no longer the equation. And it's just a matter of deciding does writing actually have limitations? Does it actually, can it affect things on the ground? And, what are the other facets that come into play about this? And I think that's still something that needs to be more studied a bit further.
What about Palestinian writing in the Palestinian territories? I mean, what's the state of Palestinian journalism at the moment?
There's been a massive influx of journalism, journalists and photojournalists, photographers especially. The situation has created an environment where anybody can grab a camera and kind of hone their experiences on the field. And the same thing with writing as well. There is, however, a lot of censorship from the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and the Hamas government in the Gaza Strip. And there are journalists who struggle to write, about issues that that will actually put them into a lot of trouble with the authorities. And it's not just about the articles, but it also can be something as mundane as a Facebook status or a social media post. And funnily enough, this is how the Israeli army, that they also look out for what they call inciting Facebook posts as well. And they have a history of arresting journalists that they consider a threat. But my generation, I feel like, social media has become this new medium where people can express their thoughts and can share their content, and they don't have to go through the traditional newspapers or media outlets that existed before. So that's why it's been more widespread in this sense.
And so does that leave you feeling hopeful about it? Do you feel like these new media, social media in particular, are having a kind of a galvanizing effect on your generation of Palestinians?
I don't want to overstress the impact of social media. I mean, a lot of pundits did it regarding the 2011 uprisings across the Arab world. You know, they called it the Twitter revolution and so on. But when it comes to reporting and shedding light on the Israeli occupation and how this family is affected by this and how this checkpoint did this to that someone, I just feel like, I don't want it to reach a point where it just all seems very redundant and very much the same story that you read every time. But I think right now the writing needs to be somehow, harnessed into being connected with the action, taking action, basically.
We'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for joining us.
No worries. Thank you, guys.
Goodbye.
It's a bit depressing. And actually, her Lena's piece ends on a depressing note, but a very strong note, where she's talking to a woman who lives in, where is she? She's in near Mahola, in the
West
Bank.
She's the Bedouin woman, I think.
But, yeah, and she says this, will your words help us to rebuild? Will they stop the army from coming? Will they help us to live our lives normally? With every question, I felt further humiliated, dumbstruck by her candour, my naivety, the truth that was staring me in the face. She said that my article wouldn't change a thing. No, you may not take a picture of me, this great woman concluded and flung the blanket divider back into place. And actually, it's a great ending.
It's a really powerful ending.
But it's very sad.
But there is still, it preserves the ambivalence of the whole thing, because Lena wasn't saying that it's completely pointless. It's a moot point. It's an open-ended thing. So it has something, all of this writing has something to contribute. You just can't kind of show that, X leads to
And I guess
y.
the thing is, by and of itself,
Africa,
it's not enough.
No, of course, yeah. Of course not. But you know,
think South Africa contributed to, which is she makes an apartheid point.
Yeah, there's a parallel to be drawn. Obviously, you can't quantify it, but surely the more attention has to, if you just stop reporting on it or stop writing about it, then it surely becomes even worse.
Toby, is this a gloomy issue of the TLS? This is a sort of Middle Eastern...
Well, it's about Middle Eastern politics, so yeah. Yes, of course it is. It couldn't not be. I mean, we've got Lena's fantastic piece on Israel-Palestine, and sort of it's partly about the status quo as well. I always think one of the ways in which Israel managed to maintain its stronghold there is by not doing very much, by just sort of not really trying to change anything, and the status quo suits Israel. Then we've got another piece, fantastic piece by Natasha Lehrer, which takes another look at Israel, and it's about its migrant populations and refugees from mostly from Africa and the way it treats them. And that shines very interesting light on the country's attitude towards its non-Jewish citizens and what it means to be a Jewish state, and whether that's actually a particularly vexed thing and an increasingly vexed thing these days.
But on that point there, Netanyahu has, in the past few days, I think, he's been trying to push forward some new legislation which would mean that they would have the power to offer an ultimatum to these immigrants.
Which has echoes of forcible Ball deportation. We're talking about 40,000. And one of the amazing things, it's a sort of small historical irony, one of the places he's thinking of forcibly deporting them to is Uganda. I think it's actually now come out that it'll probably be Rwanda rather than Uganda. I have no idea how this is going to work. Which is, interestingly, one of the places that the Nazis considered deporting Jews to in the early 1930s. Anyway, just small little historical parallel there. Yeah. So, yes, that's all quite depressing. And then we have a couple of other fascinating pieces. There's Lydia Wilson on Tunisia, which is a slightly more hopeful, ends optimistically. And, yeah, and, you know, I think one of the things about the spread of peace is it's very easy for all of us to sort of think of the Middle East as this monolith, or perhaps at best two monoliths. You know, you sort of think of Shia and Sunniism. And actually, of course, it's a collection of completely different communities and different countries. And, you know, Lena herself was talking about how fragmented Palestine itself is. Anyway, Tunisia is a different case. It's always been slightly more secular and slightly, if not democratic, then liberal in its politics. And, yeah, Lydia Wilson sees a little bit of hope for it there. It's certainly more hope, say, than the current situation in Egypt.
Or Syria.
And so, yes, that brings us on to Idris Ahmed's piece on Syria, which... no one will be surprised to hear. It doesn't give a particularly rosy view of the situation there, although he does end on a slightly upbeat note by saying the revolution lives on. What that particularly means, it's quite hard to say. I don't think, you know, anything's going to end anytime soon there.
Well, it's interesting as well, because one of the books that is mentioned in that piece is by one by Wendy Perlman, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled. And that sort of picks up on the point that we were discussing with Lena. You know, who gets to tell these stories about these people? And this book is purportedly told in the voices of, you know, it's interviews with Syrians.
And that may be a point to leave it on, actually, that Lena is this Palestinian journalist who's making this case. This book, as you say, the Wendy Perlman book, is people on the ground allowing their stories to be told. And one of the virtues of the modern world of journalism and social media is people with voices can be heard across great distance. And maybe that's the kind of thread that ties this all together.
Absolutely, the humanising aspect.
Lovely. Toby Lichting, thank you very much indeed. When you've met one person with autism... you've met one person with autism. So the truism goes about this condition, so deeply personal and individualistic, so often mislabeled or misunderstood. We're beginning to see the growth of first-person accounts of what it feels like to have autism, and Francesca Happe reviews two new books this week, Fall Down Seven Times, Get Up Eight by Naoki Higashida, translated by the novelist David Mitchell and K.A. Yoshida, and Odd Girl Out by Laura James. What can we learn about a condition that is, by some people, unthinkingly confused with social awkwardness? He's a bit autistic, people say. Or that can exist despite apparently ordinary social conditions. You don't seem autistic, as people can say when they speak to someone, like Laura James, who is married with children. Francesca Happe joins Thea and me in the studio now to help us understand all of this. Francesca, hello.
Hi.
Is there now a correct and agreed identification of what the autism spectrum is and what it means? Is there a kind of a clinical medical acceptance of what it is?
There's a set of diagnostic criteria that determine whether somebody receives a diagnosis of autism. And that's all about having social and communication difficulties and having rigid and repetitive interests and activities. But the way that those are manifest can be so variable that that's where we get into the spectrum notion. And that's why autism can look so different in different people.
And is there a problem with it being pathologized too quickly? Because if we accept that there is a large spectrum, presumably a chunk of that doesn't require medical intervention. Is that fair?
That's absolutely right. So we can think of autistic traits on a continuum, but where a diagnosis becomes relevant is where those traits are impairing for somebody. But that's really interesting, because whether they're impairing depends not just on you, but on the environment you find yourself in, the help and support that you get, the demands that are placed upon you. So you can imagine that your autism, your autistic traits, could be more impairing if your circumstances change. So if you lose your job, you lose a structure in your life, and much less impairing if you get lucky, you find a good niche. If you're a don at Oxford, you're allowed to sit at a high table and bore on and on about your own special interest and maybe not get on people's jokes, or, you know, not listen to them properly. if you're working on a production line, it's much harder to get away with those kinds of behaviours. So it's an interesting combination of your fit, your environment.
But you don't like terms like high or low functioning or severe or mild autism. You say in the piece they can almost be offensive because they pigeonhole it in one direction as good or bad in and of itself.
I think that's right. Those terms aren't very useful. And also the spectrum isn't unidimensional. So how somebody's social communication needs manifest themselves is a bit independent of how their interest in narrow interests and repetitive interests and so on are. So you have to think of autism in a multidimensional space, so that kind of high and low functioning really doesn't cut it.
And the role of changing environments in this, you were saying sometimes it will only be diagnosed once something happens in someone's life. Mm. That is partly why we hear of people being diagnosed in middle age, as is the case with Laura James.
Yeah. Absolutely. So where I work in the diagnostic clinic, we see sometimes adults coming for first diagnosis of autism in their 70s. Mm. And a typical kind of story would be you've got somebody who clearly always had these very pronounced autistic traits, but maybe when they retire and they lose the structure from their lives, or their other half dies, they can no longer cope, and then the autism just becomes much clearer and much more impairing. So that is why, as you say, sometimes late diagnosis. The other thing, of course, is that our concept of autism has changed. The diagnostic criteria have changed over time, and people are recognised now as being on that autism spectrum who 10, 20, 30 years ago wouldn't have been recognised.
And is it better to be recognised as on an autistic spectrum for the person? There's a runner risk if you over-pathologise, you actually put someone into a box that isn't that helpful, whereas...
Yeah, or does diagnosis come as some kind of a relief to these people after all of these years of wondering why they feel differently? Or
in my experience, generally, autism diagnosis is a huge relief. Mm. And one of the things I find really upsetting is that a lot of adults who finally get a diagnosis of autism will say, does that mean I'm not stupid? And often these are incredibly intelligent people, but their explanation for why they haven't quite got it in the neurotypical world, why they haven't quite understood the joke or known why they did something wrong, was that they must be stupid. I mean, of course, you don't want to pathologise something that is an individual difference somebody is living happily and easily with, but no one's going off into the streets and diagnosing people. We're talking about people who've made their way, often with a great struggle, to get a diagnosis.
But that can be true of children, of course, because unlike people who've lived through middle age where there's no framework whatsoever, you have kids who are 3, 4, 5 who are entering the system, who are very scrutinized now about their behavior, where presumably pathologization is slightly more of a risk.
I think very early diagnosis, so trying to diagnose when a child is 2, can be risky because you just don't know yet how things are going to unfold.
Yeah.
And it might be a language impairment rather than autism, for example. But by and large, I've heard for every case of a family where they've said, I wish they hadn't jumped to the conclusion of autism, I've certainly met 50 families who've said, why did it take us so long to get the recognition and the help we needed?
And tell us about, because there's a big lag when it comes to male diagnosis versus female diagnosis. Girls tend to be undiagnosed for longer, and there are different... What's going on there?
The presentation of autism in women is a really important topic and something we've got hardly any research on. Actually, historically, because we thought that there were maybe 10 times as many males as females, women have actually been systematically excluded from research. You imagine if you're trying to do a study and you're going to recruit 30 people, you think you're only going to get 3 females, you just decide to look at males. But that means what we know about autism is actually what we know about male autism. And that means when we look for autism in the diagnostic clinic, we're looking based on a sort of stereotype that is probably wrong for women. There are lots of other reasons why women probably go undiagnosed, misdiagnosed, and reach diagnosis late. It's possible that women show their autism in a somewhat different way, or that some women with autism do.
And how? Because I suppose the standard way of a boy doing it would be obsessive behaviour around individual things and sort of not being able to sort of break away from a continual cycling of the same information. Is that a particularly male thing, do you think, rather than a female thing, or is there a risk of that?
I think that there's a slight nuance on it. So it seems that women have those really narrow and repetitive interests more often on typical kinds of ordinary topics. So when a clinician asks a child or an adult being assessed, you know, what are you interested in? If a boy says he's interested in electricity pylons and he's photographed every electricity pylon, you know, up and down the country, a red flag goes up. You know, this might be autism. If a woman says, I'm interested in horses, or a girl says, I'm interested in this boy band, unless you dig deeper and find out that actually they're only interested in collecting facts about those things, they don't actually have a kind of rounded interest, then the clinician's not going to worry. So that's one of the ways that it might look different. And in terms of the social and communication difficulties, a lot of women and girls with autism tell us that they consciously camouflage their autism. They choose somebody in their class or at their workplace, a girl, a woman, who appears to be socially successful, and they copy everything about that person, how they dress, how they talk, how they act. So there seem to be different ways that women and men, in general, it's a generalization, are coping with autism.
So something like Laura James's book, Important, that she's telling a story of an autistic, the subtitle is An Autistic Woman in a Neurotypical World. What do we get from Laura James's book?
Oh, there's lots to take from this book.
Is it a good book?
Absolutely, absolutely a good book. And a really good personal journey. You asked whether diagnosis is a positive thing. You can see in the book that she struggles with both what this means in a negative way. Maybe it means she's not going to change. But also in a positive way, and it brings a whole new level of understanding and acceptance, self-acceptance and acceptance in her family as well. I think there are lots of things we can take from this book. So she's describing very vividly how hard it is to live with autism, even when apparently outside she's coping so well, when she's so successful, when she's so successful socially that nobody believes she has autism. And there's that kind of catch-22, do I have to break down and really, you know, fail before anyone will listen to the fact that I am different?
The other book, the one Fall Down Seven Times, Get Up Eight, has this wonderful phrase, which I think is arresting. We put it in the headline, The Immutable Beauties of Autism. And is there an argument there are strengths as well as weaknesses to people who are on the spectrum?
Absolutely, absolutely. So autism can be thought of as a very different psychological style, a different way of processing and understanding the world, and it absolutely comes with strengths. One of the things we've done a lot of research on is the eye for detail, the ability that people with autism have to spot and remember details of the everyday world that the rest of us miss. So occasionally people with autism are referred to or have been referred to as autists, and I've been in a setting where somebody with autism said, if we're autists, then you non-autistic people are heterotists. And one definition of a heterotist is somebody who can't spot a piece of thread on a patterned carpet. So the idea of this eye for detail, that the rest of us are just missing this beautiful fine grain of perception. But a lot of people with autism also will talk about sensory differences that both bother them but also delight them. So the absolute thrill of light through your fingers or watching water drop and being completely lost in that experience. But on the other side, also unbearable noise or the feeling of clothing. That's something that Laura James talks about, the itchy feeling of clothing being really physically painful to her. And actually even to see somebody else in itchy clothing is so painful to her, which underlies the empathy that actually is very present in autism.
Yeah, I mean, but so many of the traits that are identified typically with autism are things that, and I suppose this ties into the whole idea of there being this spectrum, that people who are not autistic or do not have autism would say that they have as well. So it makes it very clear that these books are useful well and truly above and beyond the idea of trying to understand autism itself. It's also just about understanding the way our own minds work as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, alexithymia, the inability to understand one's own emotions.
Oh, alexithymia, yes. No, alexithymia is really interesting. So that's not actually part of autism, but it's something that is very common in a whole range of different clinical groups. So maybe about 50% of adults with autism also have alexithymia. And alexithymia is not being able to reflect on and talk about your own emotions. And it's when you have alexithymia that things like recognizing other people's emotions and showing that natural, easy emotional empathy with others begins to be a real struggle. But it's very important to remember that for most people with autism, it's not a problem of empathy. They may have difficulty knowing what you're thinking, but they damn well care what you're feeling.
And they can understand notions of pain and isolation, not absolutely. Least because they're experiencing a lot of them themselves. Absolutely. But we can feel, oh, they don't get that they're in their own world, they're in their own box, therefore they don't care about us. And that's a myth that is rather persistent, isn't it?
Absolutely. No, it's completely a myth. And it's, you know, fueled by some, you know, portrayals of autism in the media that sort of almost equate it with sociopathy or, you know, sorry, with as if they're callous. And they're not callous at all. They may have difficulty understanding others, but they absolutely care about others.
Just finally, Francesca, is it fair to say things are getting better, that we're living in a time when diagnosis is more efficient, where autism is no longer a mystery or a badge to sort of push someone into the corner? Can you end on an optimistic note that we're sort of recognising, I suppose, the wonderful variety of life and the autistic spectrum is almost a manifestation of that?
I think things are getting better. I think the awareness of neurodiversity, that this isn't something necessarily to be cured, but something to be understood and supported and celebrated. I think that is a really strong movement, very much thanks to self-advocates like the authors of these books, who are really giving us their first-person view.
Francesca Happe, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Francesca Happe, Marcel Theroux, Lina Al-Safin and Toby Lichtig. Do go to the-tls.co.uk or your local shop for this week's TLS, which includes plenty more on the Middle East, as well as rediscovering the decadent Arthur Simmons and Chris Krauss on How Punk Ate Itself. Next week, we'll be looking at how the internet has corrupted language. Or has it? Like... whatever. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.